Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Wild and Unprotected. I'm your host, Koji Somalde, and here's my co-host, Ethan.
Hey, everyone.
On this episode, we talk to Bob Lynch from the Center of Coastal Studies. Bob is a level 5 disentanglement responder in the Gulf of Maine.
Let's start the show.
Classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFans account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected. Planet Earth, we can't neglect it. Nature sexy. We need this place, so please respect it.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Today's guest is Bob Lynch from the Center for Coastal Studies. He's a disentanglement specialist, and we're happy to have him on the show. Hey, Bob.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you have going on.
As you mentioned, I work at the Center for Coastal Studies, which is a nonprofit based out in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And what I do there is large whale disentanglement. So large whale species that get caught up in rope, or typically fishing gear of some variety, we go out and we cut them free, and we train people to do that sort of all over the world, and we try and gather data while we do it to try and prevent the problem going forward. So that's sort of the nuts and bolts of what I do there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Explain large whales a little bit. What whales do you work with?
So when I say large whales, typically it's like not dolphins. So it's all the baleen whales out here in sort of the Gulf of Maine, which is the main area that I respond in. We don't really typically have toothed whales. I mean, there are sperm whales and killer whales, but they're not, we rarely see them, and they're far, far offshore. So usually the whales we tend to work on would be like a minke whale, right whales, or the North Atlantic right whale, humpbacks and fin whales, with humpbacks and right whales probably being like the main two that we spend most of our time with. And so those are sort of your large whales to answer that.
The baleen whales. Those are the big ones that eat krill, right?
Yeah, the little krill and like bait fish, right? So like here, a lot of the sand lance or sand eel is a big fish for the humpbacks here. Up more off New Hampshire, that's going to be more like herring and mackerel. So, but yeah, they got the big baleen, which basically it's made of keratin, which is the same material that your hair is made out of. So these big plates that line their mouth. And so they take big gulps of fish and water, and they push all the water out, and then they swallow down the fish. Watching them feed is like a pretty cool thing if you ever get the chance on a whale watch or whatever. They're pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. We definitely aim to.
So how wide is your response area?
So it's pretty large. I mean, so like on our vessel that we respond on, it's a 35-foot boat. But we can go about 90 miles in one direction, give or take. Our direct response area is sort of here to New Hampshire border. Again, sort of do a big circle around Provincetown and of 90 degrees or 90 miles. But then we'll also help other groups and teams, say like out of New York or New Jersey, or sometimes down into Virginia. We'll travel down and can help that way. And then when you get down to sort of like the Florida-Georgia line, typically down there, they tend to have, for entanglement-wise, it's more right whales that they sort of come across. And they have teams down there that can respond to that. So usually where ours is, it's mostly local, but sometimes we travel to New York or Jersey or somewhere like that.
That's pretty big range. Before we go in any deeper on, you know, what it looks like now in your career, let's back it up a little bit. Tell us a little bit about the early stages of your career, when Bob got started and what that looked like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was like, I think, you know, if you're talking about college wise, I went to school and I wanted to either do music production or marine biology. I went to the University of New Hampshire. Luckily, there's a cool program there called Scope, Holler Scope, where you get to basically, they run a lot of concert production work through the university. So I got to do that and do a marine biology major. And so then when
that's quite the split.
Yeah. Well, you know, making up my mind isn't always my strong suit. And so I got to do both those things. And then when I left school, I was like, I have a degree in this one thing. So let me sort of pursue that for a little bit. And I ended up getting an internship at the Center for Coastal Studies, studying right whales, being an intern there. And so I started doing that and then sort of slowly just kept volunteering and working my way through programs there. So then I started doing aerial work. So you fly in a little plane and you photograph, typically up there was right whales in the winter. So I did that and then sort of joined the disentanglement team. I was like, hey, this seems interesting. Would you guys, take me on? And so they're allowed, it's sort of like a trial period. You work with the people, they sort of learn what you're like. Because for disentanglement work, you have to be pretty level-headed, sort of like cool under pressure, because things can be really, things happen real slow and then real fast all at once. And so you kind of have to have a certain type of personality that can adjust to that. So started working with them and we got along well. So then that sort of elevated my career that way. Then I moved to California. I'd grown up in New England with my partner. She had two. So we were like, let's move to California. So we did that and I ended up doing some aerial work, actually up in the Arctic. So out of like Barrow, Alaska and Dead Horse. So that was really cool. Got to see lots of cool species up there. There's bowheads and polar bears and that kind of thing. So that was a pretty cool experience. But then sort of during my time there, I missed the work at the center. We do a lot of research as well as disentanglement. So although like my job is technically to do disentanglement work, we also, we work really closely with the Humpback Studies program that's at the Center for Coastal Studies. And so we're also doing a lot of field work basically at the same time as being ready to respond to disentanglement. And they go hand in hand because the more time you spend driving boats around whales to do the field work, the research aspect, the more you understand their behavior, how to approach them closely, how to sort of what's good, what's bad, what's something, it's dangerous, that kind of thing. So I sort of did that. And then we just kept, we're at this sort of a unique place where we have lots of entanglement cases come through here. And not so much because this area sort of is a high area for entanglements themselves, but it's more that lots of different species come for sort of extended periods of time to feed in this area. And so we're more like a catch point necessarily than the cause of all the problems. And so that's why it's sort of a unique spot to get a lot of experience doing this work. Because in many other places, you might have two cases a year, something like that. Whereas ours, we might have like 12. So if you think about sort of what it takes to gain experience, to sort of do this work more successfully, you just sort of need the cases to be available. And all the work we do is under a federal, like a NOAA permit. And so sort of back in the mid 90s, there's a guy named John Lean who he sort of started, as best we know, whale disentanglement up in Newfoundland. So up there, they were still doing cod fishing for these huge, massive traps that are like, think of the size of a room, sort of all with like netting that were attached to the shore. And whales would get caught in there chasing the capelin with the fish that were going in or the cod that were going into the nets. And so this guy sort of started the idea of like freeing these animals without like sort of keeping the gear safe and freeing the animals. And then at the center, sort of what folks before me developed was how to disentangle a free swimming whale. So those ones tend to be more anchored, stuck in place. Here we are finding is where animals that were carrying gear around and being able to swim. And so then in the mid 90s, they developed with NIMS, the sort of the Atlantic Large Whale Disentanglement Network. So it's sort of the entire East Coast, everyone sort of pooling their information together. And they sort of started coming up with the idea of we should do this under permitted work. And they developed these levels. So there's 1 through 5 in sort of levels of experience. One being basically like anyone who knows what to do if they find an entangled whale. And a 5 would be you can lead a team to disentangle right whales. And the distinction between the 5 and the 4 is just the right whale species differentiation. And that's just because right whales tend to be more dangerous and powerful. And so that's sort of why they, you know, 4 is all other species. 5 is just, you can lead a team for just right whales. And so.
Must be really dangerous if they got their own level.
Yeah, they can touch their tail to their mouth. So like something that's bendy and weighs 50 tons, they're just super powerful. And they're designed to like, the way they feed is they have their mouth open and they just swim through the water. So like a lot of the techniques we use for, say, humpbacks, you know, you add a bunch of buoys, or, you know, we call it kegging because of the old whaling term. But really it's flotation that sort of encourages them to not dive as much and to go slower. But right whales, they just don't care. They're just so strong that you can keg them all you want and they'll just keep swimming. And they really don't slow down much. And so the ideas of these levels was to make sure that no one who was inexperienced went to do something that they could get hurt doing. Because if someone gets hurt doing this, it's problematic for the whole entire network. And also, it keeps people who have lots of experience, sort of forces them to work with people with less experience so they can teach people. One, so sort of forces teaching environment. And then 2, it forces the more experienced people not to get complacent. So if I'm always teaching somebody else, or if I have someone who is fresh to the topic, fresh to the thing, they might have a new idea that I haven't thought of because whoever has been doing it for so long that they're, you know, they don't really think of a new idea. They think of how they've always done it. And so the idea of these levels was really more for that, for safety and to keep people sort of like forced into learning environments where like everyone's always fresh and different ideas and ways to think about problem. There's some complications with it just in that, you know, it can be a motivator for people to, instead of working on trying to disentangle an animal, they want to get to certain levels and it's all this sort of jazz around. But that's not the intention of it was really much more of an honest one of just sort of keeping everyone in a nice learning and safe.
So who oversees level progression?
So that's, it's basically NOAA. So, right. So you have to, the level is on the permit that you work under. And the way that it's currently going to change in somewhat in how it's done. Historically, how it has been done is that you basically, people you work with would recommend you for a level advancement. And then you were reviewed by NOAA and you were reviewed by your peers or people that work in the field, like doing the disentanglement work. To be that like, yes, I've worked with this person. I think they'll do things safely and make good decisions, that kind of thing. Because if you think about it, a lot of times, the folks in a NOAA office might not have any disentanglement experience. So for them to be sort of judging someone, it's harder to do unless you have someone there who also can say, yes, I've worked with them, or these are the reasons why I think this is, you know, this is like a safe, good choice. And so that's sort of how it's done. Again, there's some changing to that, but we'll see how that progresses as time moves forward. But yeah, so it's NOAA, your peers. I think there's some lawyers involved, that sort of thing. But basically, it's all under the permit that you work under. So it's basically sort of like applying for a permit, but with what degree of experience you have.
Yeah. Can you talk about and expand on those permits a little bit? They seem to be ever so important when it comes to conservation, especially from NOAA.
Yeah. So, I mean, for most research that you do for pretty much any mammal, marine mammals, but I mean, so marine mammals are protected under the Marine Mammals, the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Many of them are also protected under the Endangered Species Act. It's sort of to do really any research on pretty much any marine mammal, you have to do it under a NOAA permit. And so you apply with whatever scope of a project you have, experience, yada, 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 and that gives you sort of, and if they grant you that, then you have you know, there's certain tasks that you're allowed to do, whatever your project might be. Those are the things you can do that's listed in the permit, and you have to give provide reports and all that sort of stuff. But pretty much anyone trying to do, especially marine mammal work, it has to be, it's all sort of has to be done under some form of a permit, with the idea that typically what you're going to do is you're going to harass, they call it harassing the animals. You might change its behavior by whatever, you know, like we do biopsies. So we shoot a crossbow with a little tip at the end. It gets a little blubber skin sample that comes off. You know, that's, we're harassing the animal when we do that. Right. And so the permit is basically saying, we understand that you're doing this, and, but here's like, you know, sort of the benefit outweighs the cost, right? Like, here's what we're going to get from this information. Here's how we're going to use it. And these are like the standards of which we're going to do that work under as well. Right. So we're going to have sterilized tips, and we're going to do, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's just a way of keeping people sort of, honest with the work that they're doing, making sure that it also makes sure that people don't, over, like, you know, a lot of people doing the same thing to the same animals, right? Like, you know, if we biopsy an animal, hopefully the idea is that then like 10 other groups aren't going to biopsy that same animal, because that's sort of, you know, part of what the idea of the permits are as well, is making sure that different projects are also in some way correlating with each other, that, you know, might have overlap in harassment and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So the intentions of the permits are good intentions.
Yes, the intentions are good.
So coming from like a citizen science standpoint, has your organization ever run into, you know, let's say like fishermen or just people on the water that have had to, that have encountered, you know, an entanglement scenario and they didn't have time, or you or your, you know, crew wasn't nearby? Have you had that happen where they've taken matters into their own hands?
100%. So, I mean, for one, we also work a lot with leatherback turtles. So they're large, awesome turtle. We get them here in our waters. They get entangled. And I guess I should also step back. So for us in the Gulf of Maine, most of the large whale entanglements we have are, it's in actively fished gear, right? So it's not like marine debris. Lots of people, you know, like there's the video of the turtle who gets the straw pulled out of its nose. That does happen. But like, if you look at the actual things that are killing a lot of turtles, I mean, some turtles, more debris is a problem, but they also get destroyed in gill nets in some parts of the world. They're getting entangled here, in our waters, in pot gear. So there's these little like TikTok things that, you know, go viral, but then the actual effects and causes of many things are, not typically what people think they are. So again, like, our whales are getting entangled. It's in actively fished gear usually. And the type of gear that it is it's sort of static gear. So that's either pot gear or gill net type material or fishing, is sort of typically in this area what we have. And it's not the fault of the fishermen. It's just co-occurrence, right? So you have all these whales are here to eat in our area, and the fishermen are trying to collect the same thing. They're here to, they're trying to get food on the table. And so it's just co-occurrence. But as far as disentanglement, I mean, turtles, it's very much a, people feel like they can solve that on their own. For us, we like if they don't, because what often happens is, this is true for whales and for turtles, where people, they try to do the right thing, but they don't. So really, when you disentangle an animal, the key part is removing the lethal portion of that entanglement. And so a way to sort of think about it is, you have your dog with a collar and a leash, right? And so say you know, your dog's a puppy, and as it grows, that collar is going to be too tight. And so if you went to save that dog and you just cut off the leash, the animal's still going to die over time, right? Because the collar is still there. And so that's typically what happens for when you have a, what we call an ad hoc disentanglement, is that they'll cut it from anchor, or they'll cut the gear that's trailing after the animal. But they don't remove the lethal portion. So then the animal still will go on to die. And that makes our job a lot harder, because we use that trailing line. That's how we grab hold of the animal and sort of gives us access to the animal. So if they cut that off, it's even harder for us, say we were to find that animal again, to even do anything. So it definitely happens a lot. We try and do our best to educate the public. It's also really dangerous, right? So people have died. There's been sort of numerous deaths and injuries of people trying to save or disentangle large whales sort of all over the world. We did have one death for a trained responder in our network back in 2017. So it's really dangerous stuff, which is another reason why we hope people call us instead of trying to do it themselves, just because it's they're so big. It's so easy to just like the barnacle on a whale is the size of a baseball. So like that thing just grazes your face, it's going to slice it right open. And like that's, you know, that's like a nothing kind of event. So, but definitely happens. But we do our best to educate the public and to sort of try and have people in our community who are going to be on the water report. The fishing industry, the commercial fishing industry, it's less so than it once was. And that's large part due to regulations and lawsuits that have happened over the years. Other parts of the world, they're doing a better job of still bridging that relationship. And it's sort of, it's a shame that it's gone the course that it has here, but so we do our best to sort of educate everyone we know that's going to be on the water and sort of help us out that way.
Yeah. So this sounds like it's a lot of work to even get to the point where you're at.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is. It's a ton of work. And sort of what we've talked about before, like it's so much work just to, you know, you there'll be a video where you go and you make a final cut and you free this animal from its lethal portion of its entanglement. But just to get there, it's all these years of training. We're on call every day, all day. Well, from sunrise to sunset, we have a hotline that someone will always answer. And so it's like, if you think about how much work just that can be, and you know, we have a small team, we're five people. And so if one of us takes vacation, you know, like everyone else then has to be around kind of thing. You have partners who have to get used to you being like in the middle of dinner and running out, like, oh, I got to go do this other thing. And then, you know, getting them to be okay with that. And you just have, you know, it's really expensive. So grants, you know, donations, all that kind of work. It's really, there's so much that goes into all of the moments leading up to actually saving an animal that no one really thinks about. And it's marine mammal biology as a whole. It's not really the most equitable thing either, right? Just so you're going to have to live in a place where there's little housing. You're going to have to not make that much money. You're going to have had to first go to a school that had marine biology. Like, there's so many things about it in this field that are really not awesome that hopefully we're going to make some changes with. But so if you think about all of that and the scope of all of that leading into just doing saving, say, one animal, it really is impressive in a way that it even happens at all. Not to like pat myself on the back. It's more like, to me, it's more like all the other people that support me in my efforts, right? It's the people who donate. It's the admin that I work with. It's my friends and family. It's, you know, it's all those people who have supported me that let me do the one thing that I found that I like, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's one thing, you know, to have the hard work, the day in, day out, what you actually do, but it's another thing to educate and bring awareness. I think that in itself is probably just as much work, if not more work, than going and being on an disentanglement call, you know? So yeah, I could only imagine, like, from all of the whale episodes we've been on and, you know, knowing Maria and just connecting with Snotbot recently on our last episode, I'm learning more about whales more than ever, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, to hear about the Gulf of Maine, and just those waters in general, because people don't realize how big the Atlantic really is. It's kind of like an unforeseen thing unless you live on the Atlantic coast. But I think the Atlantic terrifies me more than the Pacific.
And I don't know.
I'm in the opposite camp. I've flown over the Pacific plenty of times, and stare at it way more than I've seen the Atlantic, and the Pacific is pretty scary.
I mean, the ocean as a whole is like, you know, like, I don't know if you guys have been on boats like where you can't see land, but like you go out 60 miles and you feel very small.
So. Well, I'm on the Gulf of Mexico, so I'm basically on the lake. So it's not as terrifying. We get whale sharks here and there.
Jealous.
I know this is the podcast Wild and Unprotected. And when it comes to whale disentanglement and, you know, your coastal studies as a whole, let's dive into some crazy stuff. you have any tidbits or some experiences that you would share with the audience that they may not know?
Yeah, let's get to the good shit that people came here
all
for.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, you're getting pulled by, like, a large whale. That's, like, a pretty intense thing. But I feel like that's, like, the bread and butter of what I do. So it's I'm kind of like, who cares? But, like, to me, it's more back to the ocean. Like, so like my boss is like, if I could do all this work not on a boat, I'd be the happiest person. And I kind of over time agree with it. Like, you know, sometimes you're at sea and then the weather goes bad, and like coming home is a bad thing. And I mean, coming home is wonderful, but like the process.
Yeah, you go through those like shit your pants storms. Yeah, like, how the hell are we going to get through these?
I worked with Maria, who, you know, episode one, I think, of your series here. And
yeah, she actually just tried to interrupt us. She just called me like not even a minute ago as Koji was bringing her up. She tried to interrupt our show today.
Her and I
just
had Zoom drinks last night.
thanks, Maria.
Yeah, thanks, Maria. But I mean, so the way we solved that problem is we would often sing. You know, we'd be up in the driving station together and we would sing to ourselves about the weather, and that helps. But I would say one thing that like... people don't.
I'm going home in the rain.
The weather outside is weather. And then, you know, we'd make up things about how windy it was. Like one thing that no one ever told me until I experienced it, which I found like a warning would have been nice, is so right whales, they have, they're called cyamids. It's basically like whale lice that live on them. And so if you see a right whale and they have these, what they're called, callosities, rough patches of skin on their head, and that's sort of how you ID them. But then there's like this lighter sand-colored stuff on it, and that's actually cyamids or sea lice.
Like lice that we would get as humans?
Yeah, but they're like bigger, right? So they're like the size of like a nickel maybe.
Shit.
They're gross. And like I personally find a lot of insect things, I think they're cool, but I find them disgusting. But if you're disentangling a whale that has a lot of sea lice on it, it'll often be on the gear, and then you're working on the gear with the sea lice, and then they'll crawl into your gloves, and like they kind of like bite, and it hurts, and like no one tells you that you're going to get attacked. Like all this stuff is happening. You have a large whale in front of you. You're trying to do stuff, and meanwhile you have this little lice creature just like biting away at your hand. And I just think it's the rudest thing that no one told me about. Like, I feel like someone should warn you. They're like, oh, yeah, this might happen.
This gross insect thing is going to be biting on your hand as you're trying to, you know, save this animal. But have fun, though.
Yeah, like, no, like, save a whale, they said. You know, like, I don't know. I find it to be a bit rude.
There should have been a disclaimer.
Yeah, there should have been a disclaimer. I feel like that's true for most things. But yeah, I don't, as far as wild, I don't know.
I don't know. That's pretty wild. I mean, we have this show to be able to tell people about the shit that they wouldn't hear. And I would say the fact that you didn't even get a disclaimer about that, that fulfills the name rights.
And then afterwards, everyone was like, oh yeah, that could happen. And I was like, well, thanks. But you know, also the West Coast, sometimes you have jellyfish out there that, I've heard can sting people while they're trying to do their work. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Those jellies out here, they don't mind their own business.
No, they sure don't.
Well, I think that's a pretty good one. But we can move on to the next piece. So it seems like there's really two different camps when it comes to conservation. There's kind of an advocacy, I'm gonna have to cut that one. Woo! Oh my gosh, Anne Marie is messaging me at the same time. So it seems like there's two different camps when it comes to conservation, the advocacy camp and the research camp. Can you kind of expand on the camp that you guys are primarily in and what those two mean and how they interact?
Yeah, absolutely. So the center as a whole, sort of our goal as our sort of the nonprofit, it's a research sort of institution. So what we're after is science. And, you know, I think especially in the current climate where science is under attack, it's in many ways by in every field, I think it really has pushed people to reconsider, are we just science-based? Are we a little bit advocacy? Are we more advocacy? And I think it's, and then the people that are attacking science tend to just push everyone into sort of an advocacy group, which is the idea being that they're really just pushing an agenda or a thought or an opinion, whereas your science is saying, here's a question, here's the best information we have as an answer that could change, right? So that's sort of like how science works. And sort of our institution is, we really think that staying sort of as a scientific and a research base versus an advocacy group is important because it makes your, what you have to say has more value, at least in my opinion. If you say, here's a question, here are the best current answers I could find to that question, to me, that is more powerful in some respects. I mean, you can't do one without the other, to be honest. But I think if you're going to do science work, then you have to sort of really, not to have to, but in my opinion, it's more powerful if you stay strictly in the science factual lane. Then and give that tool of that fact that you found to an advocacy group and let them use it to promote a thought. Or it doesn't have to go to, it could go, if the answer proves them wrong, it could go to their opponent or someone who's advocating something different, right? You know, in this context, obviously we think of advocacy groups as sort of like the, you know, like the whale hugger kind of person. But sometimes your information could go to support, the industry or the that they're sort of fighting against, right? And I think that's important because, especially for us, the work that we do is so dependent on it's a community driven work, right? So like, unless fishermen can trust us even a little bit, or the public does to report stuff to us and help us even learn about an animal that's in distress, we'll never know and never be able to do our job. And then, you know, so like to give you some context, like about as best we can tell, about 10 to 15% of animals that are entangled in the Gulf of Maine are ever even reported to our network. Right. And then there's a percentage of that, which we can even respond to. And then a percentage of that we succeed at once we actually get to the animal. So in many ways, what we do is it's a Band-Aid on a massive cut. And so prevention is going to be the answer to this problem. That is sort of the only way that entanglement issue will change. And so by collecting gear we take off of whales, we can help sort of guide some management into what areas need to, you know, be looked at more for being problematic. Gear modifications, that sort of thing. And there's a ton of that happening. And the truth is, I don't think I'm not going to be the one who solves this problem. I'm hoping it's going to be, you know, the son of a fisherman, or some engineer somewhere, or everyone together. I'm not quite sure, but like, it won't be me. But I would love to not go to work to do this. I'd love to just do the research portion of it. Because it is dangerous, it is expensive, and it's a stopgap, you know? So, even when you do save a creature, you know, overall you're slowly helping, but it's not the most impactful. And so again, for me, the way that my little bit that I contribute is physically doing the work and then providing some sort of science that can help to inform decisions down the road to prevention.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It seems like there are so many different agendas built within, you know, kind of the fisherman community, the advocacy community, and then the research community. It's almost like everyone's got a different goal, and it's very hard to work together towards one common solution with different goals. It almost seems like if we're going to truly get that solution that we're looking for that prevents this issue or, you know, stops this altogether, it's almost like someone would have to be able to live in kind of each one of those circles to be able to move forward and kind of almost unite them in a way, which is kind of strange because everyone to me should have the same common goal towards the end of things.
Yeah. And like, I do, in many ways, people, I think folks do, but it's just the priorities along the way that get in the way. You know, like you're going to, I mean, especially in the Gulf of Maine, fishermen have done years and years of modifications to gears and meetings and all that sort of stuff that to understand the frustration that they're under is like very easy because you can say like, at the same time, you have conservation groups who are, you know, like really pushing for bigger changes and what, you know, but it's always like it's money. It's ways of life that are changing. Like there's so many assets that are happening, especially in this sort of context of this topic. And then there's, you know, in the advocacy conservation side, you have the right whale, which is a species that's going extinct basically. And so like the timeline for that isn't large. So there's lots of pressure for that. And so there's lots of pressure all around. And I agree that, you know, finding some way to unite around a thing is true, but everyone does have a little bit different perspective and a little bit different agenda. And so therefore it just makes it super challenging. And I don't have a good answer for how to solve that. Like I like to think that again, like for now, we're doing the best we can. And I'm hoping we get there. I mean, the idea of there's this idea of sort of on-demand fishing. So it's basically you wouldn't have vertical lines in the water column all the time. It'd be just when the fishers are on scene. But there's a lot of reasons why that's problematic, depending where you fish and that kind of thing. What you fish. So, but there's things like that are, you know, was just an idea maybe 10 years ago that now people are actually trialing and it's more in that community. It's more of a topic that is very much on the table. And so it'll be interesting to see where that sort of, how that develops the next few years and if it's soon enough for something like the right whale.
It's interesting, you know, that you said the topic got brought up 10 years ago. It's crazy how long ideas and change takes to go into effect in this type of community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true kind of anywhere. And I think change is hard. It is what people are asking for is a dramatic change. So it's not something that's like, hey, can you just, you know, switch to just this different type of rope and that'll solve all our problems or something, which is still a big change, still a ton of money. But like, you know, true change in industry is never going to go quickly.
And the weird thing with that is, you know, change is the one thing that's inevitable. You know, things will always change. So embracing it always seems to be the path of least resistance. So it always amazes me that it takes so long and there's such resistance to it.
Yeah. I mean, it also depends on, you know, there's a lot of people who are in the industry working hard to, you know, doing the opposite of that, right? Like not resisting change at all. They're trying everything and they're game to do anything. Like there's a lot of dudes and women who are doing that work. It's just like anything, to prove a concept works and to get it accepted in any field, it takes time. But when you have that clock of a species that's in trouble, it adds a lot more pressure.
I did want to say to piggyback the change portion that we just talked about, you know, finding like what you said earlier, Bob, about this being an expensive industry to be in. It's not like you can just go and start an organization and you're on a boat and then next thing you know, you're saving 100 whales a year. And the same thing for the other side of that. There's a caveat with the fishing industry. You know, it's not like they can just go out and implement all of this new, like new gear that's brand new to them and it helps whales and, you know, the ecosystem as a whole. Like, yeah, it might be difficult to see that change day to day, but I think over time, you know, what we're not seeing, what's being pushed under the rug, what the media isn't pushing out is people like you and, you know, the organizations like you. And then not to mention, like you said earlier, like a fisherman's son coming through and saying, hey, this is an issue that I think we should probably fix and start to implement in our, you know, next season of gear and this and that. So back to that topic of advocacy and, you know, the research portion of it, you know, you guys do research and here's the problems. You bring those problems into the light and then other people can say, hey, it's up to us to create change around these problems that you're seeing, you know, because it's all the same oceans we're in. Why not try to help each other through all of that? So I think there's hope. I definitely think there's hope moving forward, and it may not be our generation or the next generation, but it needs to be, you know, it definitely needs to be sooner than later. And that natural world, that wild world that we aim to protect, it comes at what cost?
Right.
And I think that's what everyone needs to ask themselves, whether they donate to an organization or whether they know the hotline to call. It's small things like that that lead up to big moments of change. So hopefully we can see that pretty soon.
Yeah, I agree. I would love to see that. And I agree that I'm hopeful that I'm still the best. I'm not a hopeful person, but I do think that I hope that it's a small, you know, it's the small little everyday stuff that everyone in like all these different camps we were talking about is doing that will, you know, will get us somewhere productive.
I think eventually, you know, and one of the things that you talked about earlier too was the money. I think there's almost too much money being poured into, you know, this effort for it not to become successful. You know, regardless of what your motive is, when money gets involved, normally people tend to follow. And now that it seems that we have a government that at least says they're more, you know, active and willing to put more money into the space, you know, that's going to draw people into it. So to me, once the money truly gets there, the success will follow. And I don't think that's too far away, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. And again, with all money things, is it going to the right folks who are going to be the most productive with it? And that's always a struggle.
I see this being bored out of your mind. Yeah. On our show notes here, does this pertain to your field missions and your research missions, or let's dive into that, because we need people to know what happens out there.
Yeah, let's get some brutal honesty here.
Yeah, well, it's like another one of those things that, you know, like everyone, you go to college, like I'm a marine bio major, and what they don't tell you is how bored you'll be. Because when you do field work, it's true for entangled whales sometimes too. It's like often you'll need something specific from an animal, right? Like there's whales that we've done some, basically like satellite tagging projects with. And so we are looking at the injury, the impact of those tags over time. And so like you'll need to photograph this one specific spot of an animal. And you find that whale and then it's sleeping. And so that spot is below the waterline and you just spend, you know, you can spend an hour just waiting for that whale to like wake up and move. So that you can take like one
like
photograph.
A kid on Christmas morning, wake the fuck up.
And so you're just sitting there and you're just like, holy shit. And then it goes to, you know, like that's part of the reason a lot of people that you work with, you know, I know more about many of my coworkers than my friends, just because you have so much time to sit there and like, you're like, well, What did you do last night? What's your deepest fear? You know,
and would be shitty if someone said the ocean,
right? And it happens too on entanglements. Like sometimes you have an animal that's it's anchored or stuck in a certain way that you're just slowly like waiting to get it to do a thing. So then you have an opportunity. And so much of our work is like a hurry up and wait kind of thing, followed by like, you know, 30 seconds of like, oh shit, do this. And then you wait again. And like, it's just like a funny thing. Sometimes if you step back a bit, you'll be on the boat, you're 40 miles offshore. You're, you know, on a boat with like five people who all have some sort of former, like, you know, some sort of education, all there to do this one job. And you're just like waiting for this creature to like, you know, to like wake up. And you're like, what am I doing? This is the dumbest, like, this is the dumbest reality that I never knew I would be part of. But it's all right. It's better than other things, but yeah, it can be brutally boring. It happens a lot. And I think anyone that does field work can testify to that. That, you know, there's a lot of it. You're just like, time waster, this animal is.
Yeah, like, come on, I got to go home. I got a 5 o'clock dinner. Like, it'd be nice.
Yeah, or like you're waiting to get a fluke shot of an animal and you look around you and all these other whales are doing all these behaviors that are just so much, you know, more enjoyable and productive. And then your guy is just sitting there doing nothing.
You're like, yeah, I got stuck with a boring one.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So it can be real boring. But then, you know, like, well, it ties into a gross story, but.
Oh, we're all about those.
We
bring
did
it.
Something like that where we were bored out of our mind. Well, we had done, there's a swim event to raise money every year that we provide like a support vessel for. So we're like, it was like me, Maria, and this other kid, Ev, who used to work with us. And we're doing that and helping the swimmers and whatnot. And then someone had seen a whale somewhere. So we went over there to take a photos of that whale. And then one of our stranding colleagues on the Cape was like, oh, I heard, got a report of this dead turtle that's off the beach here. And so we went over and they wanted to collect the carcass so they could do like a little like an autopsy or a necropsy. And I didn't really think it through because I was just like, oh yeah, like it's a turtle, like whatever, they have hard shells. So I went to grab it from underneath and my hand is like, it was all rotting. So my hand just like went into the carcass. So like, I was like leaning over the edge of the boat and like my hand went in. So it's just like all gross. And so like I start thinking about like, I'm like, as I'm like pulling this 70 pound turtle onto the boat. And like, as I drop it, I'm like, and like, it's, you can like see like slide off my hand. Maria's up top staring down and Ev's next to me. And everyone just starts like everyone, you can smell it. And everyone's just like, you know, we all almost barf for a while. and then, you know, you carry on. But like, so we went from being pretty bored. Like, this is actually what I love about the work that we do is, you know, in that morning of a day, we did some work for our community. We went and looked at a whale. Then we went and picked up a carcass, helping out another, you know, colleagues. And then we almost barfed everywhere. Like, but we got to do a bunch of different stuff in a period of 3 hours. And like, I find that, I like that about my job is it varies quite a bit. And so although it can be real boring, also sometimes you shove your hand inside of a turtle and don't mean to.
0 to 100 real quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not what I was expecting. I think the more we do this show, the more we find out that you have to have a stomach of steel.
That day we all were real close to not.
From picking whale poop out of your beard to dead turtle bodies that you end up inside of.
So it's interesting. The ocean's an interesting place.
It sure seems like it. It's an interesting place and we haven't even explored a lot of it yet, which is insane.
It's very true.
So there's a word that you've said quite a bit throughout this show that we've discussed that you really feel would be a great household word for people to understand. And that's entanglement. So let's expand on that a little.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked about this and then I realized that actually So there's two folds. One is the idea that animals are getting caught in gear, and the impact that it has. So, right, like, and if you look at all studied large whale populations that have, like, actually been studied all over the world, there's no population that has less than a 20% entanglement rate. If you look at the animals, you know, right whales, it's, you know, about 85% have been entangled at least once. Humpbacks in this area, it's 50% or greater. So it's this major issue that no one really knows is a problem. And so the idea is, if people understood what entanglement meant and understood also sort of how inhumane it is. So back to sort of like that dog analogy, if, you know, for an animal to grow into an entanglement, it slowly is going to cut through their body. It's not like this quick thing that they die from in a matter of hours or minutes. You know, it can be, but very rarely, like very rarely do animals, do large whales drown from their entanglement. Typically, they die from expending too much energy, dragging whatever their gear is for a long period of time, or the entanglement slowly cutting through their body, which leads to either infection or, say, at some point it ends up, you know, finally making its way to an artery. So then they bleed out. But it's like it's a very torturous sort of way to die. And so it's just, I think if people knew a little bit about the topic, then they would be, and the word entanglement and sort of what that actually means, they might be a little bit more interested in trying to figure ways to prevent it, or supporting people that are doing that work. At the same time, I realized after sort of we talked before about entanglement, like, I would love a day when it's not a household name because the problem is gone, right? I would love for it to be an issue that we've sort of, we're like, that was a thing we did. But then we came up with this way that, like, you know, is solved for the most part, this issue. You're always going to have certain things that will happen, but, like, you know, if our caseload for the year went from 60 to 2, that'd be great.
So then you'd be out of a job.
I would love it. I'd love to, like, if I didn't have to be on call, I'd be a happier person.
Then we'd have to hire him for some conservation outreach.
So yeah, I mean, that's sort of, I do think entanglement, you know, large whale entanglement being something that was more of a known problem would be cool.
So then here's a question for you. Would you rather entanglement be known for someone entangling their legs with other people's legs, maybe when they're not supposed to, looking at Jada Pinkett Smith, or whale entanglement?
I mean, ultimately, I think I would go the leg entanglement bit. But, you know, for right now, I would like that to be on the back burner for people to learn more about the conservation side of entanglement. But one day.
Yeah, it's a fun entanglement, but only when it's supposed to be entangled.
Yeah, only when it's supposed to be, and not so public.
I don't know. I think some people like public, you know, entanglements.
That's a good point. I attracted.
that gets some people going.
But yeah, so I mean, it would be cool to make that more of an issue that people are become passionate about. And it's because it's just such a hard one to solve. So the more people that know and are aware of it, the greater the likelihood that someone will come up with an idea that maybe we're not thinking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one way, you know, really to get that out there and for people to understand the concept, you know, is social media. And it can be such a powerful tool if done correctly. So do you and your organizations, you know, have social media to where people can kind of learn about this?
Yeah, ours is, I think, yeah, we have one, what's it called? Let me look it up so I say it right. We're Coastal Studies P-Town. That's our Instagram. I'm not, full disclosure, we don't crush Instagram, but we do our best. You know, we're not the best content makers, even though you think we could be better. And we have Facebook, but I think it's just Center for Coastal Studies. And then, I mean, I also plug our hotline. You can, wherever you are, if you find an animal entangled or in distress, you can call it and we'll at least guide you to someone in your area. So that number is 1-800-900-3622. And again, even if you're in California, if you call me, I'm going to redirect you to someone who can help you in your area. And we, unlike many other people, we always answer ours. It's not like a computer or something. So, and we always will help sort of get you wherever you need to be. Cause again, everyone else is our eyes and ears. So without the community, we won't be able to do half the work we do.
Dang. Even a hotline plug. That's a good one.
Yeah.
1-800-900-3622. You heard it here.
We need to make a jingle for that.
Yeah.
That's a bit of social media content for us. when we release the episode, like the 1-800 contacts.
1-800 contacts. There's some like, Medicare, like drug company that is like one digit off from our hotline number. And so we always get like people calling to reorder their prescriptions. And it's always like some old lady in Oklahoma, and you have to be like, I'm a whale, you know, responder person. And she's like, what's that? But it's funny. You could do a whole podcast on hotline calls, I think. If you got like any,
I bet that would be a funny one.
Yeah. Get like a group of people together who all man a hotline, and you get all sorts of interesting conversations that happen there.
I'm sure that's where a lot of the education happens.
It is. It really is.
Or a lot of the hazing that happens for the newbies.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you just get yelled at and you're like, okay, here we are. But
yeah, I'm just going to hang up now.
Yeah. It is a lot of like, ma'am, sir, is there anything else I can help you with? Okay. Click. But yeah.
Well, I think that that puts us in a good place to wrap the show. Thank you so much for your time today, Bob.
Let the audience know.
So you can find the Center for Coastal Study. Our Facebook group is Center for Coastal Study on Facebook. Our Instagram is Coastal Studies P-Town. And if you go to the Coastal Studies website, they have all our emails and that sort of stuff. If you want to reach out directly to me. And you can always call our hotline anywhere you are in the world. If you need some help with an entangled animal, that number is 1-800-900-3622. And one of us will always answer, and we'll do our best to help you out.
Sweet. You guys heard it here. Thank you so much, Bob.
Yeah. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Koji. Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected Podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.